Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to a Frequency Podcast Network production.
Over the past few weeks, students have been returning to campuses in Canada from across the country and increasingly from across the entire world. These students are returning to places you recognize, like the University of Toronto, or McGill, or Queen's, or UBC. And they are also returning to the campuses of schools you never knew existed, like Kwantlen Polytechnic University, a 20,000-student school in BC's Lower Mainland. For schools like Kwantlen, international students are a key part of the business model. Actually, this is true for every post-secondary institution in Canada. It's just more obvious at schools like these. And in order to keep those international students coming, they need to keep finding them around the world. And they need to sell people in places like Punjab, India, on the dream of a Canadian education. Of course, the education isn't the only thing they are selling. It might not even be the main thing. For many international students, the education isn't something that only a place like Kwantlen can offer. The education is a pathway to permanent residency in Canada, to a chance to stay here, to get a good job, start a family, and send real money back home. That's the dream, anyway. And for some of these students, it works out. For a lot of them, though, it doesn't. But every semester, there are new dreamers to be found. Is Canada's international student system ethical? Is it regulated, and if so, by whom? Who watches out for these young people who come here with their dreams and make sure that they don't fall through the cracks? And what happens if they do? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Nicholas Hune Brown is a senior editor at The Local. He looked into the big business of international students in the Walrus. Hi, Nicholas.
Hi.
The first thing I want to ask you, just to kind of set up who we're speaking about today, is just start by telling me about the Singh family and Kushandeep.
Kushandeep is he's a student here in Canada, but he grew up on a farm in Punjab in northern India. And as he grew up, he kind of increasingly saw billboards throughout India advertising Canadian international study, and that has become a growing business, particularly in that part of the world. So he made his way to Canada.
Can you describe sort of what that path looks like when you're a family who's not wealthy in India and your son starts going to school and sees these billboards? Like, what happens? What's the process from that starting to ending up in a school in Canada?
Yeah, the process is generally these students go through something called education agents. According to everyone I've spoken to, there are education agents on every corner in some of these cities. They're in strip malls. They're kind of some fly-by-night organizations. And they're sort of like a travel agent, maybe. You go in, you kind of say what you'd like, which is, I'd like to go to school in Canada. They are in charge of finding the school for you. They'll help you with your visa. They'll help you with all your paperwork. Sometimes they'll even buy the plane ticket for you and send you off. So that sort of process feels very much like you are a client and they are working for you. But in actuality, the economics of it work the other way. These agents are actually paid for by the institutions. So they receive 15 to 20% of every student's first year tuition for every kid that they can send to a Canadian institution. So in that way, the students aren't so much the clients, but they're the product that is sort of being sold to Canadian colleges and universities. So that's the first step is you are shuttled off to one of these institutions. And then you get on a plane and you, you know, there you are in Canada.
We're going to get into the bigger picture of the financials and the institutions and the lack of policy, I guess, around this. But first, maybe just explain what happens when you get there. Tell me what happened to Kushandeep.
Yeah, well, I mean, for Kushandeep, and I think this is true for a lot of international students, that I mean, he's from a pretty modest background. He never left Punjab, let alone the continent, right? And he shows up in Vancouver. His education agent had suggested he apply for a Kwantlen Polytechnic. He knew one person in all of Canada, a sort of distant cousin, who picked him up from the airport, drove him to a suburban basement, dropped him off, and, you know, he had three new roommates. He was sharing a bed with someone. Mm. And I think it was pretty shocking. Like, the kind of pressure that he was under and that a lot of these kids are under, in order to pay this tuition, he had mortgaged the family farm. You know, the Singh family earns about $9,000 a year farming, and tuition at even the cheapest Canadian college for international students is four times higher than it is for domestic students. So it's about $20,000. So obviously, like, he was hugely in debt, and with an enormous pressure. And the first thing you kind of do is you start looking for work, right? Because you are you're desperately in need of it. Education is kind of a secondary thought.
Can you explain why folks like Kushandeep would come so far and pay so much to go to school here, especially at schools like the one you're describing, which is not, you know, a world-renowned institution, of which Canada has some. So, you know, what's the draw beyond whatever education he's getting?
Yeah, I think that's sort of the key point here. The schools themselves talk a lot about, you know, people come here for a great Canadian education. They come here because Canada is a wonderful place to live. The students come here because it's a pathway to permanent residency. At least that's what they're being sold by education agents. The kind of path that's laid out is you go to school here, you do an undergraduate, or you do a college program. From that, you're allowed to get a three-year work visa to kind of postgraduate work permit in order to work here. And from that, you're supposed to be able to be kind of funneled into permanent residency. The kids I spoke to, they say that the agents make this sound like a very clear, easy pathway. It's kind of a backdoor into immigrating to a country that just happens to flow through all of these colleges and universities. So that's the primary draw. The other thing that makes Canada kind of appealing is the fact that they are allowed to work while they're here. Because, you know, for people like Kushandeep who are deeply in debt and need to work, Canada allows them to work 20 hours a week here, which is different than some other countries, than Great Britain, for example. So people come here because they're allowed to work at the same time and because it's a way to move to Canada eventually, they hope.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a six-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
And in terms of the schools themselves, what are they doing for these students and what's their draw? I assume that it's simply the $20,000 per year per student, but what's their role in this?
Over the last 10 years, the number of international students at these schools has skyrocketed. It's three times higher than it was in 2012. And a lot of that growth has happened at these little, small colleges, places that, you know, I think a lot of Canadians don't think about too often. Lambton College in Sarnia, it increased 12-fold over the last 10 years. Langara went from like 900 international students to 5,000. And so it's become a bigger part of their business. And that's happened at the same time that they've sort of lost provincial funding in a lot of places. So, I mean, these schools are dependent on international students. They're a huge part of what funds schools for Canadians. So that is, I mean, I think that's the primary draw. The schools often talk about this term called internationalization. And when you look at their promotional materials and talk to them, that image is sort of, you know, we're in a global world. Canadian students have the opportunity to learn from people from afar. You have these sort of images of multicultural students. So there's this sort of idea that bringing students from around the world to Canada is an enriching experience for everyone. I think the reality is a little bit different when these students come with sort of expectations of what it's going to be like that just aren't met once they're here.
Can you describe that reality, maybe in Cushion Deep's case, but also just in, you know, what must be thousands and thousands of students who have to come here and have to work and have to go to school and abide by all the rules from the path to residency? What does their day-to-day life look like?
Yeah, I mean, I think work is a big part of their life. I think that is a primary concern. And I think schools, you know, they like to think of themselves as educational institutions and not just sort of place that students end up shuttling through in a bigger story about how they want to become permanent residents. So when they get here, they try to work. Cushion Deep, he got here. He was desperate for a job. He ended up finding one place which paid him far below minimum wage. And I think this is common when you speak to advocates in this area. You have hundreds of thousands of, you know, teenagers or young adults with no knowledge or experience of life in Canada and the rules, who are here temporarily and feel like incredibly vulnerable, don't have the same access to the same rights that that Canadians have. So they're kind of ripe for exploitation. So you hear a lot of stories about students who are working for below minimum wage, who aren't getting, you know, who are getting not getting paid for training, who are, you know, small things like that. Cushion Deep, actually, he ended up finding a job where he was moving panes of glass from place to place. He had a terrible accident, and he, you know, at a certain point, doctors thought he might never use his arm again. He cut right through his wrist. And at that point, his employer didn't have insurance for him and said, you know, kind of denied that Cushion Deep had ever worked for him and just kind of cut him loose. Mm. So at that point, you know, if you're an international student, you have no right to get paid for disability. He didn't know if his insurance was going to come through. He was thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars in debt. His family would have lost his farm if he'd come back. So that's a pretty awful situation, right? I think that's, you know, maybe an extreme one, but the amount of pressure that these students are under is extraordinary. You think about being 18-year-old in a country just so different from where you've come from, with your sort of entire family's kind of existence on your shoulders, and you have to kind of tread this narrow path where if you switch a course and suddenly you don't have a full course load, your visa could be in jeopardy. If you fail a course, if you accidentally work more than 20 hours a week, your visa could be in jeopardy. All of these things are sort of, that, you know, maybe would be a pain to a domestic student, become this sort of existential threat if so much is dependent on that. So I think that pressure is enormous, and you hear a lot about sort of the mental health troubles that can come with that.
This sounds really exploitive, is it?
It feels that way to me, yeah. And partially, some of the students do know what they're getting into. You know, you are making this deal to try to find a way into this country through the education system. So there's no, you know, so that part is kind of on the table. But I think what's not clear, and what agents are not telling students, because of course they have no, there's no reason for them to, is how difficult that path can be, and that is no sure thing. You know, we don't have,
right.
Canada doesn't release numbers about how many students who wanted permanent residency receive it, but
that was going to be my next question.
Yeah, it's hard to say exactly, but in 2015, StatsCan found that the transition rate for international students becoming permanent residents was about 20 to 27%. So, I mean, if you look at the vast majority of the students who are kind of becoming international students right now, hoping to get permanent residency, that's a lot of people who are betting everything on kind of achieving that goal, and who are very disappointed, whose lives are changed in pretty significant ways.
This is a ton of both money and people coming into this country. Who has oversight on this? Who's regulating it? Anybody?
Yeah, I mean, the government of Canada is regulating it. In terms of the education agents, they're almost wholly unregulated. Like, there's no regulation in India. You can open up a little shop, call yourself an education agent, get some contracts with colleges or universities in Canada, and start selling Canadian education. Like, there's very little regulation that way. So that's a huge that's a huge problem.
You mentioned that this has been increasing over the past few years. How quickly is it escalating? And is there, I mean, I guess, is there an eventual cap to this where even those low transition rates that you mentioned start to plummet?
So since 2012 to 2019, it tripled. So that's incredibly quick. Canada's now the third, we receive the third most international students of any country in the world behind just Australia and America. So yeah, it's a giant business for us. Like the Canadian government says that it brings in almost $22 billion, which is, you know, it's a bigger industry than lumber, than auto parts. It's massive. It is also fragile. Like it's, I think the Canadian government throughout this pandemic in particular has been eager to figure out how to keep students coming here. Our universities and colleges are dependent on them, right? Like 40% of tuition comes from international students. If a whole bunch of Indian students decide that Australia is a more attractive country next year, like that could be devastating for these schools. So I think there are better ways to you know, keep this going. I don't think international teaching people from around the world is necessarily a bad thing at all. I think it's probably a good thing. But the way it's being done right now.
What does a better way look like?
That's kind of beyond my pay grade. I think there are like smart people have a lot of small things you could do. I think beginning by regulating education agents, which other countries have done. If all of these students are coming here with the idea of eventually settling in Canada, like the sort of immigrant settlement resources should be open to them. Right now, we're just kind of pretending that they're just students here to learn. There's, you know, at schools, there's a lot of small things around mental health, around, you know, providing mental health care in students' home languages, things like that. But I think fundamentally, it begins with like understanding that if this is an immigration program more than an education program, then we have to think of it that way realistically, and we have to treat it that way, and we have to think about what that means to bring hundreds of thousands of teenagers over each year who want to immigrate, and how do we support them, and what kind of immigrants do we want, and all of that stuff, instead of just sort of pretending that this is, here we are, they're all learning at Canadian schools, and isn't that wonderful?
Isn't it strange that the reality is so different from the image I think a lot of people have in their mind from pop culture, maybe, of international students who come in and flash their money around, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, there's definitely a stereotype that, I mean, when I started working on this piece, it's one that I had. Like, I knew that it was big business. I knew that Canadian universities were being propped up by these students and that they were paying four times as much. But the image you have is like, you know, I mean, it's probably a racist image to begin with, but it's someone usually from mainland China, and that was where most of the students were coming from prior to a few years ago. Members of the sort of global elite who pop down into Vancouver and Toronto, and they have a sports car, and you know, that's kind of the stereotype. That has changed significantly in the last 10 years. You know, India is now the biggest source of international students. All of that is shifting. I think people were maybe okay with soaking international students before when we thought they were just kind of rich kids from around the world.
Right.
But that is not who they are right now. So, you know, the fact that our post-secondary education system is fully dependent on, you know, charging them outrageous rates it gets a bit more questionable, I think.
Finally, I want to ask you about how bad it can get. You spoke with a couple of people in the community who end up shipping people home, I guess. Tell me about that.
Yeah. I mean, some of the most disturbing stuff I heard was I spoke to a funeral home owner here in the Toronto area who was telling me that over the last few years, he's noticed a real shift in his business, which was a lot of young international students who have died, who he was sending home back to India. That was, you know, he's known as for doing that kind of work. A number of them who had taken their own lives. And the statistics on that are hard to find. Like the Indian High Commission officially says that 7 Indian students took their lives in Canada in 2020. Other people you speak to say that number is higher, and there's a stigma around suicide, so that they're not necessarily reported. But definitely there are a number of documented cases of, you know, one famous one at St. Clair College a little while ago, where a number of students, they were taking a course that they thought was going to count as part of their business degree, and, you know, various complicated logistics, the government ended up not counting it, so therefore they lost their work visa.
Right.
And that just seems like a kind of, you know, something that would annoy you on your transcript if you were if you were from Canada. But for them, it was devastating. They spoke in the press about just feeling sick about it, about everything they planned being taken away from them. And one of the students did commit suicide shortly after. And there have been stories about that since. And there have been a number of organizations that have kind of bubbled up to try to support these students who, again, are just in situations under a pressure that it's pretty hard for me to imagine. So that is kind of, yeah, that is the worst thing that can happen in this industry. And it seems to be happening at least sometimes, yeah.
Before you go, maybe tell us what happened to Cushion Deep in the end.
Yeah, well, Cushion Deep, I was speaking to him for a long time. I was speaking to him before the pandemic and throughout the pandemic. After his accident, he did get help from one of these organizations called One Voice that has popped up to support students. And they made sure that he was able to get his insurance. So he, you know, he was able to do that. He graduated and he found a job making cabinets, which does count as skilled labor in Canada, which means he's on his pathway to possibly getting permanent residency. It's unclear exactly how that will work, but this year with the pandemic, fewer immigrants actually crossing the border, international students actually have a better chance of getting permanent residency than ever before. So he's feeling really positive about it. He's living in Winnipeg right now, working as a cabinet maker. He's sending some money back to his parents to try to buy back that farm. So his is a story of, of a student where it works out, sort of. he suffered a lot. He had that injury. He was exploited along the way. But the kind of the bargain he made, it looks like it'll pay off. So, his is more or less a happy story.
It's good to end with one. Nicholas, thank you so much for taking the time to walk us through this.
Thank you.
Nicholas Hewn Brown, senior editor at The Local, writing in The Walrus. That was The Big Story. For more, head to thebigstorypodcast.ca, find us on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN, talk to us anytime via email, thebigstorypodcast, that's all one word, at rci.rogers.com. And of course, in your favorite podcast player, all of them, rate, review, etc. And if you have a smart speaker, ask for us. Just say, play The Big Story Podcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together, and we were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.